That saying about politics making strange bedfellows? Yeah, welcome to 2016, huh? What happens when economic policy differences don't seem to matter? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 18th of August. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. Among the many peculiarities of this election is this one. Members of the Republican Party, long-standing former office-holding members of the Republican Party, not only not voting for their party's nominee, but voting for the Democrat in the race despite deep and significant policy, in our case, economic policy differences. One such member of the GOP is former Connecticut Representative Christopher Shays. Congressman, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Nice to be on the program.
You were, sir, when you left Congress in 2008, you were the last Republican standing in the New England congressional delegation. Why now have you come to support the Democrat for president?
Well, a big issue is why, given that I've never voted for a Democratic president or a Democratic governor. And the reason is I think Hillary is the best choice by far. I think there are huge liabilities with Trump. I think he has no experience. And in contrast, I think Hillary is smart. I think she's tough. She knows the world community. She knows the world leaders. She knows the White House and what it takes to be effective as president. She knows Congress. She served as a senator. And frankly, she knows the American people. She's been interacting with the American people for so long. And the last point, yeah, she wants government to work, and she's willing to work with Republicans, Democrats, unaffiliated voters. And Lord knows we need that.
Let me tick through a couple of policy items then, sir, on which you and she disagree. And I should say at the outset here that you, as you wrote in your piece for CNN announcing this decision that you've made, you said you vote for Hillary Clinton, not reluctantly. So here's a couple items. Number one, trade. She has said she wants to renegotiate NAFTA, which you voted for when you were in the House. She said she will oppose as president the TPP, which I would imagine you are in favor of. What is your counsel to her, and how do you reconcile voting for her even though she opposes you on trade?
Go slowly. I think she knows that the United States will only succeed if we are involved in the world community, and the trade is our salvation and the world's salvation. Will she try to be a little tougher on trade? Will she confront our trading partners who she thinks are not dealing fairly with us? I think she will.
You were on the Financial Services Committee when you were in the House. You represented Connecticut's 4th District, which has Greenwich and Stamford and all the places where the hedge fund guys live. So I imagine you know that crowd pretty well. Wall Street apparently likes Mrs. Clinton very much. She's getting all their money. What do you make of her vows to oppose Wall Street and impose tighter regulation then?
I don't know what quite to make of her so-called opposing Wall Street, but I do think she knows that you need economic growth, and it takes wealthy people to invest in our economy to hire people who need jobs.
Have you counseled her or recommended to her that she disclose the transcripts of her speeches?
I have not done that. What I do hope is that she doesn't cut corners. I'd like her to do what we did when I was a member of Congress. We called it my community meeting test. If I couldn't defend any action I took in a community meeting with comfort, then we didn't do it.
How do you get your brain around the fact then that while she has all kinds of community meetings and she talks to voters on large stages and small all the time, and I'm using this word intentionally, she continues to duck the press and avoid press conferences writ large?
You know, that wouldn't be my counsel. My counsel to her would be, you're talented, you're smart, you know the White House, you know Congress. Admit where you know probably shouldn't have done certain things and get on with it. Just be comfortable communicating with everyone.
Do you believe, getting away from Mrs. Clinton here for a minute, do you believe that a principled conservative party with sound conservative economic policies can survive this candidate that your party has nominated?
I don't know if we can survive it. It's just, to me, mind-boggling that we would choose someone who has no core base, no set of principles that are obvious. He's willing to say he didn't say something when they have tapes showing that he did say it. So there's nothing that I really appreciate about Donald Trump, and I regret my party's become so desperate. I can tell you why I think it's happened. Republicans have loved local government. You had Ronald Reagan, who got elected, talking about local government. But our founding fathers wanted government to work. What's happened is Republicans have made government the enemy. Then they've chosen not to have government work. And now they're looking for a dictator who will rescue us from our own designs.
Do you understand why Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, the majority leader in the Senate, do you understand why they have not disavowed Mr. Trump yet, based on what you just said?
Oh, I totally understand. Let's just take the Speaker. The Speaker is now given up some of his ability to be an independent spokesman. And he has Republicans who represent districts that love Donald Trump. I mean, I have family members that love Donald Trump. I have some staff members who love Donald Trump. It's almost like the North and the South, you know, where you had parents whose children fought on both sides. The bottom line is he has to respect some members who, if they oppose Donald Trump, will lose the election.
How do your family gatherings and your staff meetings go with those people who are in favor?
You know, we've agreed to that we love each other and we just won't talk about it. But I got a 4-page letter from a family member, totally disappointed that I'm supporting Hillary Clinton, and I support her, eager to see her be elected.
Christopher Shays was for many years a Republican congressman from the state of Connecticut. Congressman, thanks very much for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
On Wall Street today, it was up, but traders weren't wild about things. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the losing sectors on Wall Street today, on, as I said, an otherwise not so bad day, was the privately run prison business. Shares of Corrections Corporation of America, for just one example, closed off 35% after the Department of Justice said it is going to stop using and contracting with those private prisons. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more now on why.
Two reasons. One, the Department of Justice says it doesn't need them anymore. There are fewer inmates in the federal prison system, and DOJ expects that number to drop even more. For reason number two, here's Julie Samuels of the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute.
There have been issues about security and safety, and there also have been issues raised about the conditions and the services provided.
Issues like more lockdowns, poor quality food, sexual misconduct. And DOJ said today those issues were enough to make them want to just phase out for-profit prisons. As contracts expire, Justice won't renew or will try to reduce how much the companies are doing. And speaking of profits,
the Justice Department planning to stop using private prisons. And that is sending the prison stock sharply lower.
Stocks for private prison companies like the GEO Group and Corrections Corporation of America tanked today. Rashad Robinson watched them tumble with glee. He's executive director of the online organizing platform Color of Change and has been pushing companies to divest from for-profit prisons.
Well, we do think that it's going to harm the private prison industry, but that's actually the point here.
But this probably isn't going to put these companies out of business. Height Securities analyst Daniel Hansen says the federal prisons aren't the only way these companies make money.
They make it at the state level. They make it through selling prison services. They make it through administering jails. And they make it with dealing with other federal agencies like Immigration and Customs,
which aren't covered under this new rule. Hansen estimates the loss of DOJ business will cost the industry 10 to 20% in lost profits over the next 5 years. We reached out to the major for-profit prisons for an interview. One of them, Corrections Corporation of America, responded with a written statement saying their facilities are equal to or better the ones run by the feds. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The White House issued a disaster declaration this week for the 20 parishes in Louisiana hit by the catastrophic flooding that has killed 13 people down there and damaged 40,000 homes. Owners of those homes and tens of thousands of other people as well have registered for federal disaster assistance, which turns this into an insurance story. Marketplace's Andy Euler has it.
Almost half of the people in Louisiana's high-risk zones have flood coverage through the National Flood Insurance Program, which is about $24 billion in debt. So should people in Louisiana be worried?
No.
FEMA's spokesperson, Raphael Lemaitre.
We expect to pay every claim and every dollar that policyholders are covered for under their policies.
Rob Moore thinks that's optimistic. He's a senior policy analyst at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
It's a program that's on physically treacherous footing.
The flood insurance program was set up in the 60s because private insurance companies didn't want the risk of people who live on a shoreline or in a flood zone. Jennifer Riggins is an insurance specialist at the University of Maine Law School.
When Congress passed the program, they passed extensive subsidies, and the intent was that those subsidies would last for about 20 years, and they haven't. They've lasted for more than 50 years.
Rob Moore says we should stop encouraging and paying for people to rebuild their homes in flood zones, and we should make the information about flood damage and flood risk readily available to home buyers.
If I go buy a car, I can pull up a Carfax report and find out every accident it's been in and what repairs were done. For a house, I'm totally reliant on what the homeowner wants to tell me about floods.
There are bills already in Congress to figure out if reauthorizing or revamping the program is the smart move. The program is set to expire at the end of September 2017. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I am the younger sister, and my older sister, she is a horrible sunscreen applier.
Inspiration, family style, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 23 points today, about a 10%, 18,597 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 18 points, 0.2%, 5240. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%, 21.87. Lots of wildfires out here in the West, as you might have heard. You see fire trucks on freeways heading to the next one. Pierce Manufacturing, part of the Oshkosh Corporation, makes pumpers and tankers. Oshkosh up 2.2% today. Rosenbauer International is the world's biggest fire equipment maker. Rosenbauer somehow off a 10% today. Spartan Motors, another manufacturer, down 1.3%. As you just heard, and as I discussed earlier, the Justice Department is going to stop using private prisons. Geo Group, the biggest private prison operator, down 39% on that news. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This item today from the U.S. Department of Energy, the most recent weekly coal production report. Here is the relevant bit. Year-to-date coal production in this country is down 25% from the same period a year ago, which makes what I'm about to say not all that surprising. Just about every big coal mining company in America is in bankruptcy protection or just coming out of it. That includes the world's largest private sector coal firm, Peabody Energy, and here's why that matters. Yesterday, Peabody got court approval to set aside just a small amount of cash to clean up its coal fields should it go under and have to liquidate. A mere 15 cents on the dollar is what Peabody is on the hook for, which leaves the states, that is taxpayers, at risk for the rest of it. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The whole question here is, if a coal company wobbles and falls down for good, who pays to clean up? You know, remove water pollution, plant trees, return the topsoil. In Peabody's case, the bankruptcy court let it put up just a fraction of the money required in three key states. Attorney Howard Lerner is with the Environmental Law and Policy Center.
They're trying to shift the costs from the coal mining companies back to the states and basically onto taxpayers. And unfortunately, for example, the state of Indiana seems to have agreed to take 15 to 17 cents on the dollar.
States were never supposed to face this. In the 1970s, the federal government required companies to set aside 100% of cleanup costs. But then many states made exceptions. They told companies, if your books look good, we'll trust you. Tom Sanzillo is with the nonprofit Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
It was a nice thing while the markets were up, but the markets don't stay up forever, and yet the public needs to be protected.
So now the money's not there. In bankruptcy talks, Peabody now has leverage against the states. It can threaten to liquidate, that is, no more jobs or mines or taxes paid, or it can stay afloat and skimp on its environmental liability, says West Virginia University law professor Patrick McGinley.
The leverage that Peabody and the other majors have is a form of legal extortion.
Peabody is the third big coal company to do this. Recently, the Fed suggested they may challenge this practice. But for now, cleanup liabilities remain underfunded. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
What used to be called vocational education has had a not great reputation, really, as a dead-end track for struggling kids or for failing to keep up with the demands of a changing job market. But skills training is having a bit of a moment, actually, thanks to the presidential election. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
In a recent speech at a manufacturing plant in Michigan, Hillary Clinton got big applause for this line.
A four-year degree should not be the only path to a good job in America.
Clinton promised more support for alternatives like paid apprenticeships and union training for trades like welding, tool and die making, and coding. That afternoon,
I actually got a number of emails, which is the equivalent of a high five these days, of course, and some texts.
Jim Stone directs the National Research Center for Career and Technical Education, which works to improve skills training in high school and beyond. He says for a long time, skilled trades have been seen as somehow less valuable than white-collar jobs.
Raising that issue now puts it into the conversation at a much higher level. And even though President Obama and state governors and others have talked about this, this gets headlines.
But changing perceptions and better connecting training to available jobs will take more than headlines. Rachel Unruh is chief of staff at National Skills Coalition. The group advocates for more investment in so-called middle skills training for jobs like elevator repair, radiation therapy, and dental hygiene.
Right now, and in the next 10 years, the largest portion of jobs are going to be in that middle area, the jobs that require more than high school but less than a four-year degree.
But Unruh says you wouldn't know that from how the government spends our tax dollars. Even though jobs that require a four-year degree are a much smaller part of the labor market,
we invest considerably more resources in preparing people for those jobs.
Unruh says more than half of skilled jobs don't require a college degree, but only 20% of federal Pell Grant money supports training for those jobs. Meanwhile, research has shown that people who earn short-term certificates in fields like computer and information services or mechanical engineering can earn even more than people with bachelor's degrees. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Not far behind the Suez and Panama Canals on the all-time global trade wish list has been the idea of an ice-free Northwest Passage. Explorers spent centuries looking for an Arctic sea route from the Atlantic to Pacific above North America, completely, obviously, in vain. Now, thanks to climate change, there is one. It is so accessible up there in the summertime now that a big cruise ship is about to attempt the crossing with 1,700 passengers aboard, by far the biggest boat to make that trip. Graylin Brashear has the story.
Charlotte Brandt and her husband Bob are sitting in one of the 8 restaurants on the Crystal Serenity. They just got on board the luxury ship here in Seward after flying in from California, and they're really excited.
We just thought, wow, this is just going to be fantastic, and we wanted to be part of the great adventure.
They've paid over $21,000 each for this month-long trip from Alaska to New York via the Northwest Passage. They've been on many cruises before, but the packing list for this trip was a little different. Parka, neck gaiter, waterproof bags.
Well, we're going kayaking. We're taking a boat trip up the fjords in Greenland. We're doing a hiking adventure.
Up until a few years ago, this trip would have been impossible. But a warming world means increasingly ice-free oceans in the Arctic summer. And that's tempting to cruise companies. Crystal VP John Stoll says this kind of experience is what a lot of people are hungry for these days.
My dad, when he was in his 50s or 60s, he wouldn't dream of getting in a Zodiac and going, ashore and getting in water up to his ankles. Now, it's a driving force in the industry that people are looking for boutique experience, exclusive, intimate.
Cruise companies aren't the only ones seeing opportunity in the Arctic. There's been a big uptick in ship traffic there, but it's also risky. Huge floating chunks of ice can be unpredictable. Some of the routes are still uncharted, and ships have run aground. If they do, they could be thousands of miles away from the nearest deepwater port, which is why Crystal has planned very carefully. It's paying a British icebreaker to accompany it for most of the way, stocked with extra provisions, lifeboats, even scouting helicopters. Still, a lot of people are worried. One of them is Margaret Williams, the director of the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic program. She says people have created this new ocean at the top of the world and they want to use it and marvel at it. That can put passengers at risk, but also the environment.
We know that there will be more vessels on the heels of the Crystal Serenity, more cruise ships coming to see the Arctic as it's changing, but we are not seeing the simultaneous increase in infrastructure and readiness to respond to oil spills and disasters.
Up in Nome, Alaska, Austin Amasek works for an organization focused on protecting subsistence resources for Native communities. While the ship's visit will be an economic boon to tiny coastal communities, he says the Native people who live there worry about long-term effects of pollutants from these ships on the fish and the whales they still hunt.
I think federal agencies and state agencies really need to open up their minds to, environmental justice concerns, cumulative impacts concerns.
Crystal's John Stoll says he's aware that all eyes are on this ship.
The way we're doing it, we hope, is the right way. This is a very, very special part of the world, and we don't want to change it. We want people to be exposed to it because they should be.
In Seward, Alaska, I'm Graylin Brashear for Marketplace.
True story and full disclosure, and also kind of a problem since I live in Southern California, but I really hate that greasy feeling that sunscreen leaves on your hands. I use it, yes, but under protest. So it is perhaps not surprising then that for today's installment of our series, Summer, brought to you by a machine that will do the sunscreening for you.
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
Kristen McClellan is the founder of a company called Snappy Screen. Kristen, thanks for coming on.
Great to be here.
You got to tell me how this thing works. Describe it for me.
Sure. So Snappy Screen is a touchless sunscreen application system. And what that means is basically you walk up to one of our devices, you can select your SPF 15, 30, or 40, and your height selection. And in 10 seconds, the base rotates you and you're evenly coated with sunscreen from head to toe.
Did you just get sick and tired of having to smear sunscreen on yourself all the time? Is that where this came from?
I am the younger sister, and my older sister, she is a horrible sunscreen applier. So when we would go on family vacations, she'd still end up with a streaky handprint or the underarm marks were always classic. And so she was like, there's got to be an easier way. And kind of at that moment, it just came to me.
Talk me through the R&D process here.
Sure. So I started Snappy Screen as a freshman at Cornell University. I was 19 at the time. I couldn't rent a car, so I convinced my dad to drive me to a guy in New Jersey's house to purchase a spray tanning booth, which I wasn't an engineer, so I learned off of it. I put it back together in a backyard. That was really kind of the first place that I learned. So I ended up joining the eLab, the business incubator on campus. I went on to create two additional prototypes while I was at Cornell and run my first trial period at the Aruba Marriott. And there we had about 400 people use that device in 4 days.
Wow.
So at that point, I kind of knew that, this wasn't just a problem for my sister and I. It was
right.
A problem for a lot more people. And I decided from there not to apply for jobs and just jump straight into the business after I graduated.
What about the parents out there who just don't cotton to the whole spray-on sunscreen thing? If you're not rubbing it in with your hands, it doesn't count. Because they're out there, right? I mean,
There definitely are those out there. I would say in the industry, though, the biggest problem is both reapplication and even coverage. There aren't many people that apply sunscreen correctly. Actually, only about 20% of people will even come close. So for parents, Snappy Screen really is a great thing for them. Kids love it. They love a new piece of technology. If we're able to get kids excited about putting on sunscreen, I think that's a huge win.
Kristen McClellan is the creator of the Snappy Screen. Kristen, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. final note on the way out today, an update to our item yesterday about McDonald's and those fitness trackers it was putting in Happy Meals. Yeah, well, from the Marketplace desk of No Good Deed Goes Unpunished, the fast food giant now says it is taking the fitness trackers out of the Happy Meals after reports that kids were getting skin irritations after wearing the things. For the record here, I think my cynicism was not unwarranted. All right, we got to go kind of meh on Wall Street today. The Dow up 23 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 11 points, that is 0.2%. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2% there as well. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.